Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the sanctions imposed today by President Obama against Russia over its efforts to influence the recent election, which U.S. intelligence agencies believe were directed by President Putin to hurt Hillary Clinton and help elect Donald Trump. Nina Kusheva, a professor in the graduate program of the International Affairs at the New School and author of The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind, joins us to discuss the expulsion of 35 Russian diplomats in response to harassment of American diplomats in Russia and the closing of Russian recreational compounds in Maryland and New York used for signals intelligence. We will also discuss the broader question of whether sanctions against Putin work, since earlier sanctions over Crimea have served as an excuse for Putin's mismanagement and looting of the Russian economy. Then we will speak with Diane Winston, who holds the Knight Chair in Media and Religion at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism and is the publisher of Religion Dispatches. She joins us to discuss Donald Trump's choice of the prosperity gospel televangelist Paula White to offer readings and give the invocation at his upcoming inauguration. She was a target of Senator Grassley's 2007 congressional investigation into the spending habits of Pastor White on church-owned private jets and luxury homes. And we will explore the similarities between political magical thinking that a billionaire president will make average folks wealthier and Paula White's promise to her followers that if they give her money, it will make them richer. Then finally, we will look into the latest ceasefire in Syria brokered by Russia and Turkey that already is showing signs of not getting off the ground and speak with James Galvin, a professor of history at UCLA and author of The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. He joins us to discuss what winning the war in Syria will mean for the Assad family and what the bill will be for Assad's Russian and Iranian backers in making a devastated country habitable again, assuming the cycle of atrocity and vengeance ends. And joining us now is Nina Kusheva, who's a professor in the graduate program of the International Affairs at the New School. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nina Kusheva.
Thank you.
And I know you were recently in Russia, and I'd like to get your sense of how Russians see the recent elections and the upcoming inauguration. But let's talk about what happened today with President Obama finally retaliating, if you will, against what the intelligence community believes is Russian interference in the elections designed to help hurt Hillary Clinton and help elect Donald Trump. It seems like it's two separate issues here. The expulsion of the diplomats was in response to harassment of American diplomats in Russia. And my understanding is that's been going on for some time. It was actually a few years back that somebody fired a rocket-propelled grenade at the United States Embassy in Moscow. Unfortunately, it missed the windows and hit the wall, and nobody was killed. So let's start with that. Was this basically getting rid of all the diplomats, all the spies who are under diplomatic cover, or is this some kind of tit-for-tat for what the Americans are saying is harassment of their diplomats in Moscow?
Well, I think it's both. The incident you're referring to was after the first round of sanctions was offered over the annexation of Crimea, the Russian annexation of Crimea in 2014. The relationship was getting very tense between Russia and the United States, and the Russians felt that they are going to not only protest in front of the U.S. embassy, they're actually going to take other actions as well. And so I think that was finally a response, and in some ways probably the United States has been waiting too long to really make it happen, sort of make Russia really know how it feels about Russian behavior towards the Americans, because being 3 weeks into the end of Barack Obama's term, it's almost a little too late. I mean, I understand that the now sanctions and actions seem to be rather firm, but the way Russians portray it certainly is that sort of the agony of the administration that really doesn't doesn't know how to end its sort of to creating even more conflict before it goes out. And they very much hope that the next administration of Donald Trump is going to either reverse the sanctions or at least make it more bearable for the Russians to deal with the consequences.
Well, Donald Trump said on Wednesday, I think we ought to get on with our lives. I think that computers have complicated lives very greatly. The whole age of computer has made it where nobody knows exactly what is going on. We have speed. We have a lot of other things, but I'm not sure we have the kind of security we need. Now, of course, frankly, it's difficult to decipher anything that Donald Trump says, but again, he's making excuses and in effect, contradicting what the U.S. intelligence is saying and also what the Republicans in the House and Senate are saying.
Well, he's contradicting himself because he's the one who has been using the social media and the kind of the, this internet free-for-all behavior more than anybody, because his foreign policy and his all of his opinions are being conducted via Twitter. So in some ways, he's criticizing the administration of the current administration over its investigation into the Russian behavior. At the same time, his own behavior is very computer internet driven. So that's one thing. And another thing, of course, is interesting is that he's being very vague about this particular issue, while in terms of other issues, as we know, he's always very firm. He says, well, that's, you know, the transition is not going well, or Israel is going to be retaliated and whatnot. And suddenly, in the case of Russia, he's all understanding and almost apologetic. It is interesting that I think today he finally announced he's going to meet with the security officials tomorrow to sort of to look into the sanctions and to look into the allegations of the Russian behavior. So this seems to be a step, at least in his possibility to be educated about the issue. But I do think that, you know, as the Russians really feel that he's going to be on the Putin side, I wouldn't imagine that he's not going to be. And in fact, we already heard from the Kremlin that although tomorrow there would be certain retaliatory action will be announced, but at the same time, I don't think they're going to be too forceful, because the Russians would wait for Trump to January 20th to make it easier for him than if he's going to reverse the sanctions, to them themselves not have too much to reverse. So I think they're going to wait a month or so to push back, which they would, of course, then, if Trump is not on the Russian side, will retaliate themselves, I would say five times more, because that's what we know about Putin. If you do something to him, he's going to give you twice and thrice and even more so.
And again, I'm speaking with Nina Kosheva, who's a professor in the graduate program of international affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. So, of course, it won't be that easy for Donald Trump to just unilaterally dump the sanctions, because the Senate, and with Republicans like Lindsey Graham, Amy Klobuchar, and John McCain, all of whom are at the moment in the Baltic states, warning about Putin's aggression, etc. So it's not like if Trump, you know, use the executive authority to lift the sanctions, that the Senate and the House are going to be happy about that. So to that extent, it's not going to be that easy for him, I don't think.
Well, it's not going to be that easy, but as we know, it's not like he's actually searching for easy relationship to start with. So I don't see that as a precondition for him not to be on the Putin side. In fact, if anything, what we learn about Donald Trump, he does like to ruffle feathers and to say, well, you know, you feel this way, but I'm not. I am against you. And John McCain and Lindsey Graham are the ones that have particular problems with Donald Trump. And he does seem to be reveling the outrageousness, saying, well, they've been around for so long, they don't know where they're standing. So actually, in fact, I would even think that the more they try to convince Trump that there is a Russian problem, he would say, oh, it's all the establishment idea. In fact, if you make a deal with Russians, they are going to be eating off my hand. And I think this is something that he would try to show off as somebody who can tame Russia, can tame Putin. I don't think it's possible, but at least Trump will certainly try, or at least pretend that he tries, and then make a PR campaign out of it.
But I think in terms of reciprocity, it's going to, when you say that Putin can do, damage the U.S. five times more than they've damaged him, it's pretty clear that these sanctions are aimed at intelligence assets. I'd make a bet that 35 diplomats are either SVR or GRU under diplomatic cover. And we know, for example, Oyster Bay and the Chesapeake recreational centers, as they are called, are signals intelligence centers. So I don't think the U.S. has any signals intelligence assets in Russia. They have overheads, but they don't have them. So we don't know. Obama said that he's going to do stuff that we won't hear about. So he's publicized what he's doing overtly, but not covertly. I'm assuming that there's some covert activity going on with perhaps, going after offshore funds or something like that. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I would. And you know, it doesn't have to be, tit for tat doesn't have to be, they take, say, the Americans take those facilities, and the Russians would take other facilities. I mean, the Russians already announced, for example, today that the Anglo-American school where the children of American diplomats and British diplomats are going to school is going to be closed. So there's no. So suddenly, this whole generation of school children is going to be without school for a while. So that's a damage. They are not going to use certain facilities that they have access to. So that these are all small things, but if they're going to make it very difficult for the American diplomats and British diplomats to be in Russia, and they will find other ways. It doesn't have to be necessarily the exact retaliation, but there's certainly going to be other opportunities. Because another thing for us to remember, yes, they would be a covert operation, which I actually think is something to go with, because that's something that Putin absolutely understands. He's a guy from KGB. He knows what secret offenses are, and so this kind of covert operation he would understand. But the things that Russians can do, we don't know what they've stolen from, exactly what they've stolen, how much they've stolen. So America goes after the Russian assets. Russia releases more information, which could be damaging to Trump, which could be damaging further to the Democratic Party, to the Republican Party, to John McCain, to Lindsey Graham, and whatnot. And that's what I mean by Putin retaliates much more, because sure, the more you do to him, the more he does to you. And the information that he can release is certainly going to be incredibly damaging to the United States, to any party or any person.
And indeed, the sanctions that Obama announced today against Russian intelligence officials, most of whom are in the military intelligence, the GRU, they seem to be pretty irrelevant, because these guys don't actually travel abroad too much. And,
exactly.
But there what do you think, though, Nina, about the Special Technology Center in St. Petersburg that the U.S. has gone after? a firm called Zor Securities, also known as Esage Lab, and the Autonomous Non-Commercial Organization Professional Association of Designers of Data Processing Systems. I must say that reminds me of in the Soviet days, they used to, the government bureaucracy for nuclear weapons was called the Ministry of Medium Machines. So that has a certain ring to it, doesn't it? The Autonomous Non-Commercial Organization Professional Association of Designers of Data Processing Systems.
Well, this is also very Orwellian. This is sort of a lot of euphemism for, you know, this is a spy machine.
Right.
So that's certainly the case. But these are just a few organizations. I mean, you know, there are many more of those and there are the opportunities. But another thing that once this kind of sanctions or retaliatory measures are implemented, one shouldn't forget, and I think America shouldn't forget that. I know it is very fashionable still for sort of fashionable, I don't know, appropriate to think that Putin is alone and, you know, he has nobody on his side, and if America isolates him or he's isolated by the United States. But it's really not the case. I mean, that's how the Americans look at it, but it's not the case. Putin has a lot of fans and a lot of supporters, and, you know, if he cannot get to American intelligence, the Chinese could, and the Iranians could, and somebody else could, and North Koreans would. And he would have no problem to creating a club of anti-American supporters if America, you know, displays more hubris in his view. So this is another thing that I really do hope that those who implement sanctions and think about steps against Russia actually think a little bit ahead rather than just act upon impulse, because those sanctions certainly makes Lindsey Graham feels better or the Obama administration feels better. But all these things really should have been done long time ago when it first appeared that it is a possibility that Russians did it in June, July. And so the Obama administration wouldn't look so incredibly desperate, which it unfortunately does. And Russians are using that as propaganda like there is no tomorrow, because they are saying, you know, this is the agony, the last agony of the administration. And a lot of people believe that it is the case.
Sure, and that's just exactly the same line that Netanyahu is pushing, that Erdogan is pushing. They're all basically saying the club of authoritarians are all basically saying, finally, we got rid of this weakling and we're going
But there's a lot of other authoritarians in the world. And so, you know, when the United States doesn't, by doing that, the United States doesn't only speak to its supporters, it also gives a message to others who are not the United States supporters.
Right. Well, just in the last a couple of minutes, Nina Khrushcheva, we know that that basically the sanctions imposed after Crimea and the war in Ukraine against Russia have only helped Putin. They've provided him with an excuse for the collapsing economy, which has a lot to do with the price of oil. And, of course, the place has been routinely looted by Putin and the Siloviki. So it's played into his hands. And I believe his poll numbers have even gone up. They were around 80. Now they're apparently around 86 or 85 or something. People are very happy with how he's handled the elections here in the United States, with the implication that somehow he's been able to bring the U.S. To its knees or make fun of them or whatever. So what's the opinion on the street when you were just there only a few days ago in Russia? What does the average Russian think about all this stuff about Russian spying and the emergence of Donald Trump?
Well, the Russians think that everybody's spying. I mean, the Russians know about the NSA scandal. The Russians, in fact, host Edward Snowden, the whistleblower. So for them, the fact that the Russians are being accused of spying is a very weird concept. It says, well, everybody's spying, and suddenly we are the guilty party, because only the United States can do it, because, you know, sort of they cites this very famous Dick Cheney's line that ours are weapons of mass destruction, and ours are weapons of mass love, and theirs are weapons of mass destruction. So they just think that it's general American hypocrisy. They do the same thing, but Russians cannot do that thing. But so Hillary Clinton is not is not a positive figure in Russia. I mean, even those who do not support Trump do say, well, and she is a liar, or she called Putin Hitler. How dare she? And it is true. I mean, you know, you can, to addressing a Russian as saying, you know, that Hitler, it's a very big insult because Russia did lose a lot of people more than anybody in World War II. And so that's particularly insulting. So they're not in favor. And they're not necessarily in favor of Donald Trump, but they do think when Trump says we're going to improve relationship with Russia, they're very welcoming this kind of opportunity. In fact, I was on a country train, and I was sitting next to a machinist, and so we started talking, and he said, well, you know, Donald Trump does seem like a fool. However, he wants to improve relationship with Russia. How could we not support that? So even those who see that Donald Trump is not your average politician, let's say, celebrity TV personality, they still think it's a good opportunity for the Russians to finally be recognized by the United States as a legitimate world power.
Well, Nina Khrushcheva, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Nina Khrushcheva, who's a professor in the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into Trump's choice of the prosperity gospel televangelist Paula White to offer up a reading and invocation at his upcoming inauguration. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Diane Winston, who holds the Knight Chair in Media and Religion at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism, and is the publisher of Religion Dispatches. Welcome to Background Briefing, Diane Winston.
Thank you, Ian. Great to be with you today.
Well, thank you. And there's quite a firestorm in the religious circles brewing over Donald Trump's choice of the Reverend Paula White, a pastor of the New Destiny Christian Center in Florida. She's going to be offering readings at the inauguration, giving an invocation, along with Archbishop Cardinal Timothy Dolan of New York, Reverend Samuel Rodriguez, president of the National Hispanic Christian Leadership Conference, and other religious figures that will be there, Rabbi Marvin Heyer of the Simon Wiesenthal Center, and the Reverend Franklin Graham. So, what's your take on the fact that already there's a lot of pushback about Trump's choice of Paula White?
Well, Ian, it's not surprising that he would ask Paula White. They've been friendly for many years. She set up a meeting for him with a lot of Pentecostal and evangelical preachers early in his campaign. She's been his entree into many religious communities. They have an ongoing relationship, and she's been his go-to religious person for a while now. As many people know, he grew up in Marble Collegiate Church in New York with Norman Vincent Peale, who also was sort of prosperity gospel, although Paula White's much more into it than Peale was. Now, she's been controversial because she's very high profile, and she's pretty explicit in her prosperity gospel stance. And that could be attractive to Trump because basically prosperity gospel teaches that if you give something to God, God gives back to you many times over. And it's a way of looking at Christianity that has gotten really popular over the years, and billions of people worldwide subscribe to it. Many Christians, however, feel this is really not the gospel as Jesus preached it, and Jesus was more about helping the poor than getting rich yourself.
Well, I know that the Reverend Osteen is pretty much associated with the prosperity gospel. So are they kind of in competition, or are they soulmates?
There seems to be room for a lot of people who preach the prosperity gospel. Joel Osteen probably is the best known of all of the preachers right now because of his books and his TV show. But Paula White is among a handful of very prominent American prosperity gospel preachers.
So what was the investigation into Paula White that was conducted by Senator Charles Grassley? He launched an investigation in 2007 into spending and lifestyle habits of the Reverend Paula White and several other televangelists. I understand that she did not cooperate with the investigation.
Yes, Ian. Senator Charles Grassley, when he was head of the Senate Finance Committee, investigated about six prosperity preachers because he was concerned that they were using their 501c3 tax-exempt status to shelter items or ministries that really weren't religious, things like homes or airplanes or airports. He spent a lot of time doing this. Two of the four ministers cooperated. White and three others didn't. At the conclusion, he issued a long report detailing the financial ins and outs of the different organizations, but he did not really condemn anyone or come to any conclusions that were actionable.
Well, would you describe then the prosperity gospel? How does it work?
The prosperity gospel basically teaches that God wants people to be successful. God wants people to reach their full potential. God wants people to be healthy and wealthy. And most prosperity gospel teachers say, if you donate to my ministry, God will bless you. And so people feel that by giving generously to the preacher they follow, they will have good things happen in return to them.
But this is not directly coming from God. This is coming via the preacher, right? So there's no empirical evidence, just the preacher is acting as God's agent.
Well, yes, but the preacher is God's representative in telling people what the preacher believes God wants people to hear. So it's not coming directly from God, but the minister would say that this is what God wants.
Well, apparently Paula White's sermon, Why God Wants You Wealthy, which apparently you have to pay for to download it, the theme about it is sending money as giving a seed to the Almighty himself. And she says that, I feel impressed of the Lord to ask you to do something that I believe will create a memory in the mind of God, and this will change your future. I want you to give a seed offering that I call a gratitude seed. This is an extremely powerful seed for you, especially at a time in your life. This seed will do two things for you. This seed will get God's attention. Remember, God sits high and looks low. He is looking for faith on the earth. This seed will require strong faith. This seed will be seen as a gratitude offering. Gratitude always produces favor, and favor will cause you to receive in a moment more than some do in a lifetime. And the recommendation for buying a gratitude seed on her website is $115. So that's what it costs. And is there any evidence that the $115 has been multiplied?
Well, first of all, what she's saying is par for the course for prosperity gospel. It's called seed. It's called planting a seed, and that's a common term for many ministers. And the amount people ask for varies. Now, you and I would have to go visit many congregations and talk to many people to see whether or not this really pays off and whether people are financially blessed if they tithe like this. But it's important to remember that Paula White and Joel Osteen did not invent this. This was what Jim and Tammy Baker were doing in the 80s. It was, you know, akin to what people have been doing for several decades. So this whole idea that if you give to the ministry, God will bless you, is not new. It's surprising, and if you haven't heard of it before, it's shocking. But it's quite a popular Christian perspective. Now, there are many Christians who think that this is, you know, heretical and are horrified by it. But as I said earlier, there are millions of people worldwide who believe this works.
Well, in terms of the people who are horrified by the choice of Paula White to offer up a prayer at Donald Trump's inauguration, the Eric Erickson, who's an influential Christian writer, he's on his website, he's really going to town on her, saying an actual Trinity-denying heretic will pray at Trump's inauguration. What is her heresy in terms of, do you follow what his theological objection is?
I saw his website, and on it he said that she denied Jesus, I believe, or God. I don't follow him, so I don't know whether he's legit or if there's any basis to that.
Right. Apparently, his complaint was that on television, she listened to a man say, "Jesus is not the only begotten Son of God. He is not. I am a Son of God." And apparently, Paula White agreed, "He's the first fruit." That doesn't seem like a major transgression, but maybe it was just in the moment, you know. But in terms of, I mean, I can see that, as you pointed out earlier, Donald Trump's had a long relationship with Norman Vincent Peale's Bible Collegiate Church in New York. Peale apparently officiated at Donald Trump's first wedding, and Trump co-hosted Norman Vincent Peale's 90th birthday party. So what is Trump's version of the prosperity gospel as we know it in terms of the religious influences on him? Because he's not, it's pretty hard for a lot of people to get their heads around why the religious right in this country, the evangelicals and fundamentalists, Christian fundamentalists, voted for Donald Trump, because he's a thrice-divorced owner of gambling dens who openly, in a video that was captured, talked about coveting his neighbor's wife and feeling that he had the right to grab women's genitals and get away with it.
I don't think religious Americans voted for Donald Trump because they felt he was an exemplary Christian. They voted for him because they believed that he would do the right thing on the issues they care about. They voted for him because they believe that he will put someone in the Supreme Court who will make it very difficult, if not impossible, to get abortions, that may back away from transgender bathrooms, that may back away from same-sex marriage. You know, there's a Christian idea that the message is not the same thing as a messenger, and oftentimes the messenger could be flawed, but that doesn't mean the message is wrong. And Trump very clearly said that he was on the correct side of many religious issues, and that is why people voted for him. Because unlike Hillary, who was known to support a pro-choice position, who was fine with same-sex marriage, who was fine with feminism, Donald Trump had come out against all those things. And the fact that he was correct on their issues is what convinced religious people to vote for him.
But without being too cynical, do you think the man who wrote, or at least claims to have written, The Art of the Deal, who touts himself as a deal maker, and the suggestion is that his presidency, he's going to make a lot of good deals for America, that's what he's promised on the campaign, that the man who's a deal maker, do you think that there was a deal made with putting Mike Pence on the ticket? Did that deliver the Christian vote?
Putting Mike Pence on his ticket definitely helped Trump convince Christians that he would keep his promise vis-a-vis their issues. And whether or not that was a deal or not a deal, it looked like a clear statement of purpose. So in the Trumpian universe, it was a good deal because it delivered votes for him. And whether that was cynical or not is besides the point. The point is to win, and that helped him win.
And he, well, there's some dispute as to whether he won.
Well, it helped him. It helped, yes, as, even as I said that, I wanted to walk back my words. It helped him win the Electoral College.
So just in the last couple of minutes then, Diane Winston, there is another theological objection to Paula White coming from the Southern Baptist leader, Russell Moore, who tweeted, and apparently this is how people get their messages out nowadays, quote, "Paula White is a charlatan and recognized as a heretic by every Orthodox Christian of whatever tribe." That was what the Southern Baptist leader, Russell Moore, tweeted. Again, any sense of what her heresy is in his eyes?
I would think that Russell Moore, who's been very outspoken in his dislike for Trump and has been one of the leading Christian conservatives who basically said Trump is not fit to be our president because of his lifestyle choices. What Trump is referring to is a prosperity gospel. Conservative Christians would find the idea of this tit-for-tat relationship with God, you know, you give to the minister and then God gives back to you, they would find that antithetical to what they read in their Bibles. There's nothing, that's not the basis of Christianity. Receiving God's blessing is not the only teaching in Christianity that they would adhere to. God may bless you, but there's a whole lot more going on in Christianity than that transactional relationship.
Well, just in closing, though, is there a connection or a parallel universe here, if you will, between Donald Trump and Paula White and Osteen and the prosperity gospel people, in as much as Donald Trump, in many ways, is promising the white working class voters that his success will somehow rub off on them? And he's made that promise both implicitly and explicitly. And when, you know, confronted with the fact that he's basically got a cabinet full of billionaires, he said, you know, that's good. The billionaires, I want successful people. That'll help you. So does that also apply in the religious realm of the prosperity gospel? Because if Paula White and Osteen, Paula White, you know, what Grassley was looking into is how come she's got so many mansions and flies around in a private jet. What has that got to do with being a tax-exempt religious foundation? It seems that her followers and Trump's followers basically believe in a way that if you support somebody that's rich, it's somehow going to rub off on you.
Donald Trump is a political embodiment of the prosperity gospel. Basically, he preached to crowds, if you believe in me, if you support me, if you give me your vote, I will multiply that vote many times over with the blessings you will receive. Now, whether those are the blessings of no more abortion, or they're the blessings of jobs, or the blessings of the end of NAFTA, they're manifold according to Trump. And many of the same people who would flock to Joel Osteen or Paula White because they want to believe that if they give a little, they will receive a lot in turn, have also looked to Trump for the same reasons. Now, you can say, as you said earlier, well, how do we know that, you know, this really works? Well, it's hard to know with those ministries, but come next year, we're really going to know if it worked as far as Donald Trump goes, because we'll see whether the country is prospering as he has promised he said it would, or if we are in worse shape than we were before.
Well, Diane Winston, on that note of anticipation and perhaps dread, I thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Ian. It's been a pleasure, and I hope we can speak again.
And indeed, and Happy New Year to you.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Diane Winston, who holds the Knight Chair in Media and Religion at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism, and is the publisher of Religion Dispatches. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back looking into the latest ceasefire in Syria brokered by Russia and Turkey that's already showing signs of not getting off the ground.
الأسود الأسود يا ويلي الثوب الأسود يا
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is James Galvin, a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. And his latest book is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Galvin.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
And let's start with the ceasefire announced by Russia and Turkey, which they broke it. And already it does seem that it's, I don't know whether it's going to get off the ground even, does it, when one of the rebel groups is saying it's not going to agree to the ceasefire?
Well, ceasefires work regardless of violations of ceasefires and regardless of the unanimity. I mean, it takes political will. In other words, think of it this way. In Vietnam, from 1974 to 1975, there was a ceasefire. 25,000 South Vietnamese soldiers died. 45,000 North Vietnamese soldiers died, but it held anyway. Now, the thing is that in this case, there are incentives, as odd as it may seem, for both sides to sit down with negotiations after a ceasefire that would hold. For the government, what the government wants to do is it wants to lock in the gains that it's made, particularly since the period of last autumn when the Russians intervened alongside the government troops and Iran and Hezbollah and actually pushed very, very strongly against the opposition. What the opposition needs is they need to lick their wounds, time to lick their wounds, and also they need to figure out what they are going to do next and how they are going to go about doing it. So a ceasefire would work to the benefit, actually, of both. Now, that being said, there's another lesson from Vietnam, which is the fact that both sides in Vietnam use the ceasefire time for their own advantage, to prepare for the final battle. The South Vietnamese, for example, used it to rearm and to retrain. The North Vietnamese used it to rearm and to redeploy. The North Vietnamese got there first, and that's how the war ended, as it did.
Well, the group that's rebel group that's on late Thursday said that it had unspecified reservations over the ceasefire is the Al-Har al-Sham. Al-Raha al-Sham. So that you don't think that's a deal breaker for the rest of the rebel groups?
It's ambiguous what they're saying, first of all. Second of all, they are the largest of the groups. There are about 150 groups on the ground in Syria at the present time in the opposition. So it is a significant problem. But it doesn't necessarily mean that this is a deal breaker. The question of whether or not they will be brought around is another question. Now, your audience should also understand who these people are, Ahrar Shan. They are a very, very close in ideology to the Saudis. They are what we call Salafis. They are extraordinarily puritanical, and they want to turn Syria into an Islamic state. Now, the idea that they would maintain themselves outside of the ceasefire while, for example, the Russians and regime would continue to batter them, I don't really have much feeling or much sympathy for them either.
Well, it feels, though, with this growing closeness between Putin and Erdogan, and particularly in the context of yesterday's tit-for-tat between Secretary of State John Kerry and Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, you get the feeling that the authoritarians like Putin and Erdogan and to some extent Netanyahu, who's not, you know, he's a right winger in the context of a democracy. But they all seem to have a collective contempt for Obama, and they just seem to be gleefully waiting for him to leave. And I get the feeling that a lot of this working together between Turkey and Russia is aimed at giving Obama the finger.
Well, that's in part true. I mean, Obama, when he took office, wanted to get out of the Middle East. He felt that George W. Bush had spent too much time, blood, treasure on Middle Eastern problems. And so what he wanted to do was to restore what the American position had been before the end of the Cold War, which was something called offshore balancing. In other words, we would hold the coat and protect the back of any of our allies in the region, be it Israel, be it Saudi Arabia, be it Turkey, and what have you. But they would do the local policing. And since the end of the Cold War, the United States has taken a direct role in doing the local policing. And this is why there's this contempt that they feel for Obama. Why not be a free rider, as Trump would put it? Why not, for example, have the United States intervene on your behalf wherever possible? So, I mean, there's that aspect to it which is very important. But that's not the only thing. I mean, the United States, for example, is its most important allies in the struggle against ISIS are Kurdish forces, whether it's Peshmerga from Iraq or whether it's the popular protection units, which are Syrian Kurds, or the Syrian Democratic Forces, which are Syrian Kurds mainly, with some Arabs mixed in as well. Turkey, of course, is at war with its Kurds. And so the American and the Turkish interests are colliding here. America wants to get rid of ISIS, and in order to do that, it needs the Kurds. Turkey is fighting a Kurdish insurgency. They consider everybody that the Americans are working with terrorists, and so therefore they and the United States are at loggerheads over this. The Russians, of course, are sitting back and saying, hey, look, we're just proving our point that, you know, we stand by our allies. We're using Russian orders for military equipment have skyrocketed since they intervened, demonstrating that they could be used effectively in places like the Middle East. So, you know, and the Russians just like the idea of poking the United States, be it George W. Bush, be it Barack Obama, you know, poking them in the eye. And that's exactly the main reason why Russia got involved in this whole mess.
Right, but the Kurds and the Turks had a ceasefire and a peace deal, which was going well until Erdogan decided to reignite a war against the Kurds in order to take over more power and in the country. Meanwhile, of course, Erdogan was helping the Underground Railroad of all the jihadis flocking in to fight the Islamic State. So he hasn't been particularly helpful, I would say.
No, and he's certainly no Democrat, as you pointed out. I mean, he is part of this new upsurge of authoritarianism that we see everywhere from the Philippines to the United States to Western Europe and France in particular, and, the Middle East and Russia as well. So, I mean, there's a history to be written there, but we're going to have to wait a little bit in order to understand exactly what is going on globally.
Sure. And again, I'm speaking with James Galvin, a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria and the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. And his latest book is The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Needs to Know. Let's turn then to the idea that winning, in quotes, the war in Syria, what will that mean for the Assad family and what the bill will be for Assad's Russian and Iranian backers to make this devastated country whole again?
Well, that last sentence, I think you mean ironically. The country will never be made whole again. We're talking about about deaths, about 470 to 500,000 people have died. 1.9 million people have been injured. 45% of the population is either internally displaced or refugees. The overall poverty rate is 85%. I mean, we're talking about a country that is in ruins. They estimate that infrastructural damage and economic losses, economic losses alone are about $250 billion, and add to that infrastructural losses, schools, hospitals, which were the targets of Russian and Syrian regime bombing. That's another $200 billion. So we're not going to get there. Unfortunately, Syria is gone. And I say unfortunately, I really mean it. I mean, I've lived there. I enjoyed my time there. I have friends there. But that Syria will never be restored.
But it's extraordinary to think that this family did this because they felt they had the divine right to rule. And it's pretty clear that most of the 500,000 the people have died at the hands of Assad. And yet he is absolutely dancing around like, you know, pictures of Hitler at in his Alpine retreat, you know, just happy as a clam.
Yeah, there's... In the Catholic Church, you were just, I listened to your previous segment, in the Catholic Church there's always been this debate about justice and charity. Okay. Now, justice demands that he hang for his crimes. And there's no doubt about it. Charity demands that the Syrian people, that the suffering of the Syrian people end. So what we have to do is figure out a way of, you know, balancing out this idea for justice and for charity. And maybe it means that what we have to do at the present time is accept an Assad government that would relieve the immediate effects of, for example, the Russian scorched earth tactics in Syrian cities. It's unpalatable, I understand. I'm not happy with it either. Maybe this is what the future holds.
And in terms of the change in the landscape and the strategic architecture, what do you think of this idea that the so-called Shia Crescent has become a reality, the idea that Iran can now project its power through its proxies in Iraq, Syria, and into Lebanon?
I agree with that idea, but we have to be very cautious about this. It's not that Shiis and Sunnis are propelled by their Shiism and their Sunnism to become antagonistic. It's that Saudi Arabia and Iran are at a more than a cold war. They're fighting a struggle for who will be the dominant local actor in the Middle East. Iran, of course, tries to mobilize, sectarianize Shiite populations by saying, look, the Sunnis are out to get you, and, you know, this is what you have to do. These Saudis have been doing the same thing with the Sunni population as well. But ultimately, the problem comes down to the fact that Iran is a power that doesn't like the balance of power now in the Middle East and wants to upset it, and Saudi Arabia is a status quo power that wants to maintain what's there. And both of them are waging this fight with each other, you know, throughout the Middle East, from Libya to Saudi Arabia itself, to the Gulf countries, Syria, et cetera. So, I mean, they're wrecking the Middle East with this particular battle that they have. Now, it's interesting to note, by the way, that during most of the Cold War until 1979, for those of you who say, look, Shiis and Sunnis never get along and that sort of stuff, for most of the Cold War, both Saudi Arabia and Iran were known as the twin pillars of the United States. They were the ones who kept the Gulf secure on behalf of the United States. They were on the same side. It's only now, at the end of the Cold War, when Iran, having had its revolution, is in the opposite camp of Saudi Arabia, that we see these problems developing.
So in terms of Syria and this current ceasefire, which may or may not hold, and obviously the siege of Aleppo is over, but the fighters have moved out into Idlib, and the war continues. And it would seem to me that even if there is some kind of Turkey and Russia and Iran can pull together some kind of deal with the Assads, surely you're still going to have some kind of insurgency. That's what the CIA director recently said, and it seems to me fairly logical that you really do have a very deeply embedded cycle there of atrocity and vengeance.
Oh, you're absolutely right. Neither side will achieve its goals in negotiations. The government wants to destroy the opposition. It ain't going to get that. The opposition wants to overthrow the government. It ain't going to get that either. So basically, there is this ghost in the background of these sides negotiating, but understanding full well that this can at best be a temporary solution. The former UN ambassador to the Syria crisis, Lakhdar Brahimi, called what he thought would happen in Syria Somalization. In other words, Syria will become like Somalia. The government will have control over certain areas, in the case of Syria, the western part of the country from Damascus to Aleppo and points to the Mediterranean. And then there'll be pockets of opposition-controlled territory. The Kurds will control the northern area and the Far East as well. Hopefully, in the not-too-distant future, ISIS will be destroyed in Syria, so it'll be out of contention.
So, and then what do you think Donald Trump's going to do then? I mean, he ran this campaign and basically, and that Obama's the weakling and we're going to be tough and stuff and we're going to get things done and solve problems. Even if he and Putin can be two peas in a pod, it doesn't sound like you're going to solve that problem.
Well, too bad this is radio because I just shrugged my shoulders. I've been doing a lot of interviews around, you know, Trump versus Obama in terms of the Middle East. First of all, we don't really know what Trump's going to do in large measure because he doesn't really know what he's going to do. He has made contradictory statements. The one thing that we do know, though, is that he, Flynn, and people around them consider ISIS to be an existential threat to the United States, the same way that the Soviet Union was an existential threat to the United States during the Cold War. So therefore, since it's us versus ISIS, he will seek allies to help us with the struggle against ISIS. And very likely those allies, Russia's there right now, Russia will be aligned with the United States in this as well. Turkey doesn't really care all that much about ISIS, as your statements earlier indicate. They'll cooperate, I'm sure, in a campaign against ISIS, but frankly, their real concern now is the Kurdish question.
Well, incidentally, ISIS is on the ropes. I mean, they're being exaggerated at any rate. And, I think obviously they may be dispatching their people into the West for terrorist actions as they get defeated and rolled up. But still, they're in the overall scheme of things, they've always been exaggerated as a potent threat. So maybe Trump will take credit for what Obama has succeeded.
Well, one of the ongoing debates now in policy circles is what's next in terms of ISIS, and there's a whole bunch of scenarios on the table. Will ISIS, for example, will they go underground and fight an insurgency? Right. Well, it's possible they'll do that, but then it won't be ISIS anymore, because ISIS, of course, is this global caliphate they want to set up.
Right.
Will people just say, I've had it, and find some other criminal enterprise they'll do? That's very possible also.
Sure.
The one thing that's also very likely is that their international reach in terms of propaganda will not be as great as it has been in the past, if they don't have territory from which to send that propaganda.
Sure. Well, we've run out of time, and I thank you very much for joining us here today, James Galvin, and I wish you a Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too.
And again, I've been speaking with James Galvin, a professor of history at UCLA, whose research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria and the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories, and he's the author of The Arab Uprisings, What Everyone Should Know. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.